Yeah, well, that has been, that subject has been picked at. And of course, a tremendous white flight job was done by the press and the little reporters of the day. But even in our, among our own people, a great many things have never been discussed about that. I was there. I was on the square. I heard the bullets flying. I saw the guns in action. I saw the solemn meeting that was held down on Scarf Street, where we called a conference because we discovered that in our attempt to get away from the downtown area and back to the fairgrounds, where we rather expected there, another attack would be underway on the Treacherous, we found our way blocked by a full squadron of mounted men sitting, waiting under the railway trestle that we generally passed under our way up to the exhibition grounds. Now, sworn evidence that the inquiry said that the mounted men had been sent for after the riot got out of hand. In the first place, it wasn't a riot, it was a deliberate attack. In the second place, we attempted to march out of the downtown area within 10 minutes, 15 minutes of the outside of the blowing of the whistle and the attack. And within an area of 3 blocks, we found a squadron of horsemen sitting, their horses in good condition, carefully marched, a matter of, by actual measurement, over 3 miles from their barracks. Nobody ever thought there was anything wrong with the obvious fact that to be where they were, in the condition they were, if they'd been ordered out after the blowing of the whistle or after the riot got underway, those horses had to travel at a speed of over 60 miles an hour. And yet they were in perfect condition to carry out their assigned duty within 10 minutes of the whistle. They're saddling up and they're 3 miles accomplished. And yet, they continue to deny that this wasn't a planned, deliberate, provoked attack. It was nothing else but. The question arises, do I believe that nobody was killed? I do not. I am absolutely certain, in spite of the sworn testimony of the investigation, I am certain that men were killed that night. Men have disappeared. Men that we had faith in, men that were reliable, men we knew for years, their last known existence was 1st of July. And I know of at least 6 that disappeared that night and have never been seen again. I know a family right here in Victoria. One of them I worked alongside in the shipyards. The other one has been and still is a troller. The younger brother of that family, by the name of McElroy, disappeared from the face of the earth in Regina on July the 1st of 1935, and that family will say that to this day. This boy who never failed to write at least twice a month to his mother. His last known existence was on that part of the square that night. Were the people killed? Of course there were people killed.
There were many arrested, there were some shot.
There were 40 people taken to hospital with gunshot wounds. Every gunshot wound was 38 caliber or 45 caliber, which indicates that the shots were fired by the 38s of the city police and the 45s of the mounted police. No trekker was armed at any time. Any man who had been caught even carrying a semblance of a weapon on his person would have been immediately banished. So the whole concoction of lies that passed as evidence of that story is exactly made up to cover
the deliberate attack that was staged on July the 1st.
Yeah.
And then, that lesson wasn't enough. People still were confused. And until I was able to write the story, which is now available, of Bloody Sunday in Vancouver, people were still willing to accept the official version of riots. They were not riots. They were deliberately planned attacks. And Mr. Lynch, who claims a great deal of glory for his share in the art gallery part of the Bloody Sunday, is well aware that the attack was planned. And he knew it was being planned and knew it was going to be carried out and never gave us any warning, nor did he appeal to the people to come down and help us avoid it. These things were planned and deliberate. And any suggestion that the unemployed rioted, in every case I can remember, particularly the post office in Vancouver in 1938 and Dominion Day of July 31st, 1935, they were deliberate attacks. And the reason that attack in Regina was necessary was that we were disappointed that we hadn't carried on and given them a chance to annihilate us to a great extent in the wilderness. The Iron Heel was being stamped down, let's make no mistake about that. Bennett's threat to use the Iron Heel was a real threat. And this was his opportunity. And they made the best of it because they knew that we were wise to the tactic that was going to be carried out. So there, it's so easy to get bogged down in the story of the trek. I didn't start out to talk about the trek, except as it reflected the life of Arthur Evans's. Arthur Evans's life and work among the working class of the people of Canada that we're interested in right now. And this was only a part of it, because Arthur Evans, as a man, what made him go? What made him run? What made him tick? This is what we're trying to find out. And those of us that worked with him, and those of us who were part of his work, got that sense of urgency that was in him all the time. We got that fire that he was just burning himself up. And his day-to-day life was the class struggle. He had a devotion to the cause that was almost unique in his generation. The only time I can recall Arthur Evans in a relaxed mood at all was when he was in one of his favorite places. In the Finnish settlements around the Shuswap Lake that are situated at Sorrento and at Dunedin, Arthur Evans was welcome as he was in no other part of the world. Because I made Salmon Iron District my stamping grounds for a year or two after the trek, it was my headquarters no matter where I roamed. I always came back to Salmon Iron because I some very, very close family friends there. And so whenever there was a Arthur in his function as the organizer for the Workers' Unity League, he always seemed, there were only two places he was happy, either on the picket line organizing workers in industry or out among the farmers preaching the unity of the farm community. And it always impressed me the way those, particularly the older people in the Finnish community, the way they treated them. The way their eyes would light up when they came into their homes. The way, as they gathered at whichever farmhouse the meeting was being held in, the way they gathered, and as they came in, they immediately sought Arthur out, and the way they shook hands with him, the way they held onto his hand, the way they spoke to him, was a thing that you had to see in order to get the picture of the high personal regard they had for him. And I came to the conclusion long ago that these older Finnish people saw in that Arthur Evans, that burning light that was forever stirring up in them, they saw there a reflection of the folk heroes that they knew in their struggles over in Europe, because most of them had come from a very active struggle against the serfdom that they were subjected to in Finland. And the BC Finnish communities are populated by people who were practically banished from their country because of their activity in the struggle of the people of Finland. And I know, and I always got the impression, that they saw in Arthur Evans, this man burning himself up with zeal for the cause, they saw in him a reflection of their known folk heroes that they left in the, and that died struggling for them in the, in what to them was the old country. And I saw a side of Arthur Evans I don't think that too many people saw, because when he was there, the older Finnish women, for instance, they mothered him. They could hardly speak to him. They didn't have enough English to speak to him. But they were forever wanting to see that he had the best chair in this little farmhouse, that he was protected from the drafts. They knew exactly how he wanted his coffee. They kept pressing him to have some soup, have some coffee. They took it as a personal insult that he came into their house a long, skinny, string bean, just bursting with energy and burning himself up. And it was always a great disappointment to them that he didn't show signs of a real good meal before they left their house. They seemed to devote their lives into trying to make him look like a man who'd been well fed. And they annoyed him sometimes by pressing him. And this was their way of showing that although they couldn't speak to him, that they were getting across to him the fact that they loved him and they respected him. It was a unique thing to see. And the old men would be sitting listening to him, and he'd be telling the story of farm unity, the possibilities, the cooperative method of working, and so on. He would dig up some reading material he brought with him, and he'd read them something, and he'd divert off to a story of some other experience somewhere else, and so on. And it was a treat to see the old Finnish farmers sitting back there, and there was always either the second or third generation giving a running translation of what Evans was saying into the Finnish, so that the older people could follow the trend of the discussion. And you see the old white-haired gentleman with the white mustaches and sometimes a white beard sitting there, all wrapped up in what Evans was telling them, and then you'd hear almost like a Baptist camp meeting, you'd hear murmurs from this corner and that corner from all over the room. Yes, Archer, I foresee that. That is how I think it should be. In the old country we had sometimes somebody say so. And in their broken attempts at English, they kept murmuring that they were getting the story through their grandson or son's interpretation or their granddaughter's interpretation, and that they knew that what he was telling them was so. And it was like almost like a Baptist meeting, this constant background of agreement. And yes, Arthur, before that kind of thing we see and we know that is the truth. Yeah, yeah, that is so, Arthur. Yeah, it could be because we have before seen that. And this constant echoing of their feelings towards them was a unique thing to see. And then afterwards, as the formal discussion was over and there would be questions asked here and there, and some old farmer would have his grandson interpreting for him because he couldn't think well enough in English to get his story over to Arthur, some little problem. Arthur had a rather unique approach in that while he was listening to the interpretation given by the grandson or granddaughter, as the case may be, he never took his eyes off the old gentleman who was speaking to in Finnish in the language that he didn't understand. And it occurred to me then that this was typical of Arthur Evans. He was projecting himself across to that person as a person. And this is one of the reasons that those people actually loved their Evans. They saw him for what he was. He took them back to their really vicious struggles that they'd seen in their youth in the old country. And to them, he was another unique leader in their lives. And the value that those Finnish settlements put on Arthur Evans as a man and as an organizer and as a really trusted teacher and leader, it was something to see. And so when I think of Arthur Evans, I worked with him. I was in the struggles and the fights with him. I saw him in the street battles that were forced on us. I saw him in the hard work of organization. I sat in meetings there where he was sometimes criticized because of his attitude there, where he saw there was far too many people who were not prepared to take part in the struggle, and he would adopt the sneering tactic of saying, you people don't believe that. You people are still hoping that if you burn up enough wheat and enough sugar and enough coffee, and if you destroy enough things, that your bosses will give you prosperity. This is what you prefer to believe. You don't want to get in the struggle, some of you. And he used to browbeat them, and he used to actually infuriate them. And it was all planned because he knew that they had to get rid of that preconceived idea that the bosses had foisted onto them, and that every weapon of the church, the courts, the police, and everything else was used to dominate the minds of the working people. Arthur knew he had to destroy that, and he wasn't above screaming at them from the platform that he suspected that some of them didn't wish to be disturbed out of their comfortable order. But this didn't happen in the Finnish community. The Finnish community saw through that man as his own people didn't see through him. And I don't think there was any place in the world that Arthur Evans, as a man, as a devoted leader, ever showed up better than he did in that community. And if you can, now they must be gone now because they were old people then. I don't know what the young people in that community feel like now. I don't know how much they remember. But I wish you could go to Sorrento or Glen Eden to the Finnish district around Shuswap and contact somebody who remembers their father and grandfather's feelings towards Arthur Evans. And you'll get a picture of that man that I think is the best picture of him, because those people who had seen the struggle at its most vicious as it existed in Europe immediately saw in him that this was the genuine article. No phony peddler of ideology, but a man who fought and a man who lived for the struggle and a man who actually put himself out into the struggle. These people saw that as nobody else did. And this is one thing about Arthur Evans that few people saw, and yet I was there and I saw it. And when Arthur Evans went up to the Okanagan, a district that he absolutely loved, and I don't know why he loved it, because all he had to do was appear there, and he was overwhelmed with invitations. To keep peace in the community, he had to spend part of his time sleeping in a bed in the Mackeys, and then the next week it had to be the Costa Mackeys, and then the next week it had to be at the Salonans, and the next week it had to be at the others. And he spread himself all over that community. And people would gather in whatever farmhouse he was located in. And quite often we'd have meetings there, and there'd be some of the Canadian, British background farm community there. But it would be predominantly, because it was held in their home, it would be predominantly Finnish. And everybody always brought a little something along towards the coffee and cake and so on that we always finished up with, and made a kind of a social gathering out of it. And the door would fly open, and in would come the Koskenaki family there, and whichever house was, say he was in the Mackies and the Koskenakis just arrived, old Mrs. Mackie would come over and say, "Ah, Mrs. Koskenaki, bring your kind of cake, our dear, she know you like the coffee cake, and this is a part of Arthur Evans, the fact that he meant so much to those people, people who were, whose whole ancestry was steeped in the struggle. They knew that Evans was the genuine article. And that's a side of Evans that I don't think too many people know. And I'm glad I was there, and I'm glad I saw it. Because in working with him, I know that a lot of his zeal, a lot of his always reaching for tactics rubbed off on me. Even to this day, whenever a situation arises that involves the working class, whether it's a back-to-work order by the cabinet, I immediately say to myself, given the situation of responsibility for that strike, what will my action be now? I wonder right now. I frankly wonder what's wrong with the labor movement now, that we worked so hard to get started and has now become such a part of boss collaboration and the support of the system. I wonder why they haven't seen that the only tactic that you can use against government orders to return to your work or else. There's a simple tactic. If every railroader, when that order was issued in Ottawa, had gone down and exercised his right as a Canadian to change his job, if he'd have said, "You're ordering me back as a railroad worker, but last night at midnight I decided I'm a truck driver," and they had gone down to the local employment office and said, "I want to change my occupation. If you people want to run a railroad with untrained people without regard to safety, go ahead and hire some railroaders. I'm no longer a railroader. I'm a truck driver. I'm a market gardener. I'm this and that." This is the tactic that would have defeated this law, this tactic that the bosses have now adopted of, "We will pass an order and council drag them back to work." And I know that Arthur Evans would have used that same tactic. And it's the first tactic that occurred to me. And yet, there are no Arthur Evanses left.
Well, perhaps, Steve, when they read your book and the one that will be done about my father, perhaps it will give them a book, a code of ethics to follow for a change.
But you see, there is, perhaps, this is where we should be. Arthur Evans didn't belong to the Communist Party alone. He didn't belong to the Workers' Unity League alone, although he was the mainspring of it. He let it be known at all times that he belonged to the working class people of Canada, and he devoted his whole life and his whole energy to it. And the sad thing about it is that in summing up the whole situation that's developed since then, and realizing that perhaps what should have been the most carefree and happy years of my life, I was able to devote to the struggle because I wanted to, and because I thought it was right, and because I believed that the Evans type of man was the best type to solve the problems of the people of Canada. Because of that, it hurts me to say that long ago I have come to the conclusion that we no longer have time. We no longer have time to institute socialism, because I think we reached a point of no return long ago. I greatly fear, and I hope I'm wrong, but I'm afraid that I'm right. I greatly fear that the only alternative facing the people on this continent now is World War III or the fascist state, because the labor movement that we devoted so much of our youth to, and that Evans devoted his whole life to, has become a collaborationist organization now that cannot lead the people out of this coming period of depression that's just about upon us. And it breaks my heart to say that because the Evanses were so damn few, with their sincerity and their effort and their burning fire of revolution, because it was so damn few, our revolutionary sun has gone down while it's still day. And that means that the night of fascism or war is going to be that much longer. I think perhaps if there's a sad thing in my life, it's the fact that I've come to the point where I realize that this is the inevitable fate of the Canadian people. It's a damnable thing to think of, that because there were so few Evanses, I'm afraid that that's how it's going to be.
I won't comment on that. You leave me rather sad, too. I'd like to thank you very much, Steve Brody, and I would also like permission to use the material on these tapes for my dad's biography.
Like your father, Art Evans. Everything I've said and everything I can do belongs not to me. It belongs to the working class. That's where they...
Well, now we're going to get sentimental. So
No. We don't get sentimental. There's no room for sentiment. Arthur Evans never demanded sentiment. All he asked for was fight. Okay, let's run it back over now and see how it goes.